Welcome to Bicom's Hadiyun podcast. We're on episode 18 and we are delighted to have with us Anshul Pfeffer, who is the writer of the acclaimed new biography of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, The Turbulent Life and Times of Benjamin Netanyahu, which is available from all good bookshops. He is also the correspondent for The Economist and a prolific writer and reader of Israeli politics. Welcome, Anshul, to Bicom's podcast.
Hi, James. Thanks for having me.
So what we wanted to really talk about today and get your thoughts on is really trying to look ahead to what's going to happen in October in Israeli politics. And we saw some glimpses of that this week, where Prime Minister Netanyahu was saying that unless he can get some kind of a deal on this military conscription law that is amenable to the ultra-Orthodox parties, then he will sort of go to early elections. And what I wanted to just talk about with you is, what is the nature of that threat? What is the deal that needs to be done about military conscription and the ultra-Orthodox? And then we can talk about early elections. But yeah, if we could just talk about, you know, those first two points.
So let's start with the second point about early elections. Israel's going to have to hold election at the very latest in November 2019. That's the furthest date in which the current Knesset can serve. And basically, in October, when the Knesset returns from its long summer holiday and Chagim holiday, Israel's going to the Knesset will almost be in a in an election mode already. The only question really is, what's the date?
Yeah, so you think that they'll just, you know, come back in October and it will just be a sort of, you know, downward sliding towards just when the early elections are called?
For Bibi, the question of when to hold the election is not an easy one, because he has to, at the same time, work out whether for him the best thing is to have an early election, which will help him to preempt possible announcement by the Attorney General of a criminal indictment, and he'd prefer to be re-elected first, and for the Attorney General have to face the not easy prospect of having to indict Prime Minister with a renewed mandate. On the other hand, like every Prime Minister, why would he want to give up on another year in power for the uncertainty of an election? And this is not the best of times for Netanyahu to go into election, with Gaza still rumbling in the background and a lot of the Israeli public, including his own right-wing base, not very satisfied with the way he's been handling it. So into the mix comes the story of the draft law, which has been around basically for Netanyahu's entire decade in power now, because the Supreme Court over a decade ago ruled that the arrangement exempting yeshiva students from military service is unconstitutional, and it basically allows for inequality. And the Knesset has been struggling ever since to try and legislate a new draft law. Netanyahu's government asked for another extension from the High Court a week ago. They asked for 7 more months. They only got 3 months of an extension. So Netanyahu's going to have to try and find a way to get his coalition, and particularly the ultra-Orthodox parties, to support the law. Or he will have no choice anyway but to go to early elections. So this gives him an opportunity to basically decide whether he wants to go to elections now or to find a way to settle things with the Orthodox, which I believe he can do. There's no Israeli politician who's got more experience in dealing with the Haredi parties than Netanyahu has. He's going to have to make this decision in the next few weeks, at the latest in early October when the Knesset comes back.
But if he calls early elections, so even if it was November, then that takes us what, to a sort of February election?
That's more or less the framework. February. We're talking about a February March election, or an election in May June, or an election after the next Chagim in October November. Those are basically the three options. I mean, elections can't be too close to high holidays, to Pesach, Independence Day, etc. So, you know, that we have more or less three periods in 2019 when the elections can be held.
And just so we understand the issue, essentially the conscription law is about larger numbers of ultra-Orthodox yeshiva students going into the army, and those numbers gradually increasing, and the ultra-Orthodox basically arguing over those numbers and the rate of increase and other detail. Is that a decent summary?
That's a decent summary. I mean, the numbers, both in the law, which has already been disqualified by the High Court, and the draft of the new law, which the legal experts who drafted believe this will pass the High Court test. Both these laws have various tables of annually increasing quotas. The new law has slightly higher quotas, and it also has the provision that if for 3 years running the quotas aren't met, then the law will automatically basically disappear, and all the yeshiva students will be immediately liable for being called up. And that's one of the main bones of contention. When you talk to most of the ultra-Orthodox politicians off the record, they admit that the new law won't make a big change to life in yeshivas or have a major impact on the number of serious yeshiva students still studying their Talmud. And they'll admit that they can live with the law, but the Haredi politicians don't call the shots. The shots are called by the rabbis who appoint them. And there are a number of those rabbis, mainly Hasidic rabbis, who feel that this is too much of an intrusion on yeshiva, on their community, on yeshiva life, and they're steadfast in opposing the law, and that's what's creating Netanyahu's headache. It could be creating his opportunity to call early elections.
So where do you see a deal? Will it just be on reduced numbers?
No, I don't see a deal, because the law right now has been drafted in a very careful way to give the Orthodox parties most of what they were asking for, and at the same time to be able to stand up in the High Court, because there'll be petitions against this law again. I see very, very little wriggle room. And on a public level, and this is why even Yair Lapid and his Yesh Atid party voted in favor of the law, the IDF has endorsed the law as well. But any significant change, anything really more than a minor tinkering, will shatter the consensus around the law. So it's really very much down to those Orthodox rabbis to find some way to accept the law.
Right, right. Kalev, I think you had a question.
In previous discussions on the podcast, we've said that the majority of the coalition partners don't want elections. They're likely to lose seats. Clearly, there need to be elections by November 2019. So the closer we get, the more itchy feet people will have. But I'm interested, Ancho, whether you think that assumption is still true, that the majority of the coalitional partners would rather stay in the government rather than go to elections.
Well, Netanyahu's favoured political alliance has always been with the ultra-Orthodox parties. They've always been the parties that he's worked with best. He's worked with them better than Jewish Home and its forerunners, better than he's worked with other right-wing parties and centrist parties. He'd always prefer to have them in the bag when he's forming a coalition. And both sides are aware of that. On the other hand, Netanyahu has said in private in recent months that he would prefer after the next elections to have a larger coalition, which would mean another centrist party, probably Yesh Atid, and it would make the ultra-Orthodox less pivotal if they are in the coalition. So I think in many ways, both sides, Netanyahu and the leaders of the Orthodox parties, are playing chicken with each other, because they both sort of know that they need each other, but there could be a possibility after the election in which Netanyahu will try and either undercut them by having a wider coalition or leave one of them, Shas or United Torah Judaism, out in favor of a centrist party. And that's another of the reasons why most of the ultra-Orthodox politicians would prefer to work with Netanyahu on this, and are slightly frustrated by their rabbis telling them to stick it out.
Yeah. If we can just look at a situation where, say, after elections are called, if they're called, and how we assess the situation of the opposition. I mean, we had a situation earlier in the year where Bibi looked like he was in trouble. There were corruption investigations. You know, there were questions about whether he was going to be able to run the country properly if he was spending so much time with lawyers. But then he had this extraordinary three months or so. Trump moves the embassy The Iran deal is basically torn up by the US on their side of the deal, and it looks like Bibi is kind of in the ascendant. But then, like you said, his handling of Gaza over the last few weeks has certainly come under scrutiny. But it still doesn't look like Yair Lapid, Avi Gabay, Tzipi Livni, anyone is really landing any blows or making any inroads into his support that is looking pretty good in the polls. I mean, how would you assess that?
Well, I mean, you made a very good point. May 2018 was probably Netanyahu's best month ever. Netanyahu's other consideration in timing this election is that even though the chances of him losing seem, at least at current polling, quite slim, this is an election in which he's fighting for his freedom almost, because if he does lose this election, the next thing are criminal indictments, years in court, and if Ehud Olmert's precedent is anything to go by, he could be the next prime minister to sit in prison. So he sees renewing his mandate as a way of blocking any indictments.
And he blocks the indictments how? Just because it becomes harder for the Attorney General to make that decision to indict him if he's a sitting prime minister with a renewed mandate? That's your assessment.
I think that's Netanyahu's assessment. Netanyahu has already twice faced an Attorney General who could have indicted him. Eliakim Rubinstein in 1997 and then again in 2000 was sitting in front of clear recommendations by the police to indict Netanyahu on criminal charges. Both times he decided not to. And this is at the end of the day down to one public servant, the Attorney General. And any decision to indict someone, certainly if that person is a powerful politician and the prime minister, is not a simple decision, because the weight of evidence may seem very heavy, but these are white collar cases in which there's no clear cut piece of evidence in which you could say, oh, he took money and promised something in return. These are all very circumstantial, I think quite convincing, but still circumstantial collections of evidence where the Attorney General has to make a very difficult choice. And Netanyahu believed, and perhaps with good reason, that the choice becomes that much more difficult when he's a re-elected prime minister.
And your assessment, I mean, from what you know about the man and your extensive research about him and your theory that he's a very, very cautious politician, will he go for an early election in February, March, where he maybe feels that he can predict what's going to happen over the next few months, that time of year has worked for him before, like it did in the last election, rather than wait for the uncertainty of another spring, summer, potentially even more problems in Gaza and elsewhere, and perhaps too risky an option in November? What do you think?
I think that Netanyahu has a serious dilemma here, and I think that as next few weeks, if Gaza somehow simmers quietly and doesn't blow up, and if the draft issue becomes a bit more complicated, and we're already having indications that Avichai Mandelblit, the Attorney General, may not delay his decision until 2019, as some predicted. And I think the now calculation is that he should try and preempt the Attorney General. And I'm beginning to think that his decision will be to hold earlier elections than we thought, and will be going to the polls by February. But that is totally conjecture based on how I see his him weighing up his options. We're hearing every day different things being said, both on the record and off the record, about the possibility of early election. Bibi himself said a couple of weeks ago he wants this government to serve until the very last moment in November 2019, and then we heard on Sunday him warning the coalition party leaders that if we don't find a solution immediately to the draft law, then we're going to have early elections. So we're hearing him blowing hot and cold, and the same thing is happening in private. He is weighing up these options. I don't think he's made his decision yet.
And do you have any evidence that the opposition parties have a campaign that they could put together that will be coherent, compelling, fresh, new ideas, or will they just do kind of more of the same?
So Yair Lapid's campaign has been, since he joined politics over 5 years ago, about new politics. This is we've come to make a change and bring a new style of politics. We are the ordinary middle of the road Israelis, and we will represent you in the parliament and make a change for you. And that campaign has worked for Lapid well in 2013, a bit less in 2015, but it still kept him in the picture. He's still Yesh Atid is still the second largest party right now in the polls. So I don't see him making any changes in his campaign. The real change with Yair Lapid will be in his after-election strategy, how he deals with Netanyahu. Will he make another pact with Naftali Bennett and demand Netanyahu take them together in coalition? Will he try and this time to be the leader of the opposition instead of whoever's the leader of the Labour Party? I don't see his campaign changing before the election. The really interesting question about the campaign is how Zionist Union or Labour plan to run their campaign. So we have Gabay, who's never run a national campaign. He ran a very successful primaries campaign to become Labour leader, but he has no real experience of running a national campaign. And his partner, who is the official leader of the opposition, because Gabay is not an MK, is Tzipi Livni, who's run so many national campaigns for so many parties. I think she's even forgotten how many. And how these two people who don't really have a natural relationship, how they succeed in running a campaign together. And I think Livni and Herzog in 2015 ran a better campaign that they were given credit for. They gave Netanyahu a run for his money. They got 24 seats, which was better than most people predicted Zionist Union would do. So we're going to have this old war horse, Tzipi Livni, and this newcomer, Avi Gabay, running a campaign together. The weakest point of Zionist Union's campaign in 2015 was that Herzog just couldn't look prime ministerial. So what kind of a makeover are they planning for Avi Gabay, who has yet to capture the imagination of Israeli voters? How are they going to present him as the prime minister in waiting? I think that's going to be really interesting. We've already seen the glimmer, the beginnings of the Zionist Union campaign in the statement that Livni and Gabay put up together just before the Druze rally last weekend, when they said that when they get into government, they're going to bring the Declaration of Independence from 1948 and pass that into law as Israel's constitution. That's their counter proposal to the nation state law, which they've opposed. And that, I think, could be a very interesting manifesto on which to run their elections, to kind of re-establish Israelis' commitment to the Declaration of Independence. That could prove to be a compelling campaign, but we'll have to see.
Anshul, that's been absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us. Just a reminder, Anshul's book is out now, a biography of Bibi Netanyahu. It's very readable. It's excellently written, so I thoroughly recommend it. And just a final announcement to our listeners, please do rate our podcast. We will be taking a short break, not a European break, but a US-style one-week break, and we'll be back after the August bank holiday. Thank you for listening, and thank you, Anshul.
Thank you for having me.